this is Martha Nix Wade with An Exposed Secret. I am so thankful this evening. A few years ago, I had the pleasure of meeting Vince. And Vince, the first time we met, we were in a Starbucks.
That's right, yeah.
And at that time, you had just come from Florida, and you were a very broken man.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And it's just amazing to look at you now and see your wholeness and your joy and just know what you have done over the past few years to come to this point. And I want you to share with our listeners, you know, what happened to you in your childhood that led to our meeting at Starbucks where we got to start working together and knowing that you're not alone. And so just talk about your childhood and share with our listeners what that was like in your early childhood and paint the picture for them.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. For me, well, first, my name is Vince. Hello, everyone. And I think the biggest thing for me as a kid was trying to have the perfect life, you know, going to church and doing everything and realizing that every time I got more involved with church, it was just a jewel in my crown, as people like to say. And I think for me, the biggest thing was helping out my mom, who was the disabilities director at our church. So disabilities ministry, helping out all the kids with special ed. And it was just huge, huge ministry. We loved it there. And that's where I was introduced to a gentleman at the time named Richard. And he befriended me instantly. And I loved the attention. You know, dad was out of the home. So I needed that and I craved that male role model.
And how old were you at this time and how old was Richard?
At the time I was, when I very first met him, I was 11 and he is 8.5 years older than me. So he was about 19 going on 20 at the time. So to me, you know, 11-year-old kid, hey, that was just amazing that someone actually paid attention to me that was older than me. And I had no idea. I didn't care. I said, hey, He's a cool guy. He drives and he wants to hang out with me. Awesome. I want to do it. So yeah. So we would hang out and he was my friend and we would do things together. He would buy me stuff. He would shower me with the gifts of whatever I wanted, you know, whether I wanted to go out for pizza or whether I wanted to go out to ice cream, go to Disneyland, Magic Mountain, whatever it is. He would take me and it would be a big, thrill for me as a child to say, oh man, this is what I want. This is awesome. I have a friend that that truly cares about me, especially for me. I guess the naivety of a child, even more so in the church, was I met him at church. So instantly my thought was, he's a Christian. It's totally fine. There's no issue at all with anything that he's doing because he's a Christian and he knows better than me because as we are all taught growing up, our spiritual elders, we need to respect them and do what they say. And so for me, that's how I kind of grew up and interacted with him. And he was an interesting guy because he came himself from a broken home, you know, the hard life, I guess, of a Latino in Southern California. I suppose it's, you know, kind of as you hear all the time, you know, that's how it goes, unfortunately. And so the facade that he painted was one that he needed help and he needed a leg up in life. And so my mom being the uber saint that she is to just charity upon charity to give to everyone. And she opened up her home to him and for me. And I was just thrilled beyond belief that I had my friend actually living with me and she thought it was such a great idea because one, there'd be a male role model in my life and two, there'd be another a strong Christian figure in the home, as we all thought. And so it was, progressively, as I guess things usually go, progressively got worse and worse with things with the relationship that we had. It went from the, you know, showering with gifts to there needs to be some kind of reciprocation as far as, hey, you love me, I love you because we're Christian. So, give me a hug every now and again, you know, let's go to the gym together. He bought me a gym pass at it when I was 12, you know, I thought, oh, cool. I want to go work out and be fit. And so we'd go to the gym every day. We would, shower at the gym and do all that stuff at the gym, work out, try to be fit. And he would just constantly try to push the envelope, so to speak, with me and, invade the boundaries of my life. And I felt that at the time, I thought, hey, well, he's a strong Christian. He knows what he's doing. He's an adult. So why wouldn't I listen to him? Why wouldn't I do what he says and understand that he has his best, he has my best interest in mind. You know, as a child, that's what you automatically think with people, especially people from the church. And so the relationship kept growing and progressing. Well, looking back, progressing south. And, you know, he, in his own words, he would try to protect me from all the people that would look at me at the gym, you know, and that would try to take me away or try to hurt me. You know, in his words, he was protecting me from people that were trying to hurt me from others. And so he would, you know, usually crowd around me, hug me or hold close to me. And he would make sure that we would shower at the gym because to him, being sweaty was dirty. He didn't like that, but he just was all about the showers. And so he always would say, oh, well, California's in a drought. We need to share. We need to be closer together in the shower scene. We need to do whatever it is that that would help us grow closer as brothers and also as just helping the earth in his words. And so for me, it was perfectly normal. And then at home, you know, it got progressively worse there. And he introduced me to pornography, and he showed me what it meant to, in his words, quote unquote, take care of yourself. Because if you allowed these sexual feelings in your life from pornography or from looking at women or whatever it was to manifest itself, then you would fall as a Christian and you'd go to hell. So I felt, oh, well, I have to masturbate because I can't. You know, I don't want to go to hell. I need to do that. I don't want to go on out and have sex with a girl because that's wrong. But doing it to yourself is okay, as was he described me. So, but of course, I'm 12 years old, 13 years old. I don't know what I'm doing, you know. And so he, I guess looking back, the mental manipulation was extremely strong at that point because he pushed me to the limit of literally asking him to help me. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. And every time it was the degradation of myself, you know, putting me down. And then, you know, he would constantly, you know, tear me down to build me up, tear me down, build me up. So I was basically his puppet in that sense. And so one day, you know, as we were, you know, masturbating together on a bed, whatever, and he just kept saying, oh, you're doing it wrong. And then I said, well, will you just help me? Because I don't get it. I don't understand. What am I doing wrong? I'm doing everything you're doing and it doesn't make sense. You know, I thought I'm doing it right. And so he said, well, let me show you. And he does it. And then from there, you know, progressed into, well, you know, as bad as you can probably imagine. And that happened, you know, every day, 5, 6, sometimes 10 times a day until I was, went away to college. And it was a tough life, you know. Looking back, I realized how tough it was. But at the time, I was just a kid growing up, and it was no big deal because I thought everybody was doing it.
Right, and I remember one of the most amazing things I ever heard you say was, it happened so slowly mm-hmm. that it normalized itself.
Absolutely.
That you had no idea that you were being any different from every other boy in your class.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, and that was huge for me because the way he painted the picture for me of this is the normal life. This is actually a good thing to do. This is what you should be doing because if you go and have sex with people, then that's wrong. But this is how you curb that desire. And this is how you become a better man, become a better husband, a better father, everything. Like he was the picture that he painted for me over the years. Was and constantly daily, day in and day out, was the that this is going to make you better. And so every day was just a little bit farther, you know. And so for me, at, you know, towards the end, it was, you know, it was no big deal. It was almost automatic in a sense for me to take a shower with him. It was automatic for me to, you know, satisfy him sexually, or, you know, and that was automatic for me because, you know, there was no. Almost like there was no feeling with it. It was almost like robotic in that sense because it almost didn't matter to me because it was to me, it was like brushing your teeth. Like it's just something that you do every day and that's it.
Right. Mm-hmm. At what point did you feel that you were numb to those emotions where it was automatic?
Oh gosh, it was probably a couple of years in, I'd say sophomore high school. Probably I was just, it didn't matter to me anymore. Like it was almost like I don't want to say it was like a drug, but in a sense, it was one of those where like I needed it to feel normal in a sense. And the way he conditioned me and the way he, you know, molded me in his way to feel that way, it's almost like, you know, like me coming home and doing my homework. That's just what you do. You're going to sleep, you waking up in the morning, you know, whatever it is, and 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever times a day. And, you know, then we made it in a competition. We did all kinds of things because, you know, I was in sports, you know, in high school and college and, you know, scholarship athlete, the whole thing. So for me, that competitive drive was huge, and he would use that to his advantage, unfortunately. And yeah, the numbness factor, though, it was very, very, very prevalent, you know, for years. So,
and where did he make that transition? Because he was saying for so long that this is how you don't sin by being with women. So how did he have you cross that line to start satisfying his body sexually? Was there a transition, or were you so numb at that point you didn't question that transition?
Well, it was... No, at that point, because it happened pretty early on. I was still in junior high when that first happened, and I would say, gosh, probably the way that he really kind of pushed the boundary for me to satisfy him and to do all that was, you know, after he showed me, so to speak, you know, he would do it for me, and you know, and I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay, you know, that makes sense. Okay, now it's. For me, it was almost like teaching. You know, he was literally the teacher and I was just the student learning. And then, you know, after a few times said, hey, you know, I'm doing all the work here. Do you want to help out and, you know, do me so, you know, we can, so it'll be, in a sense, save time. And so at first I was like, no, that, you know, I don't really want to do that. And so, and then he didn't push, and he said, okay. And then the next time, then it was, you know, hey, I'd really appreciate it if you would. And just, you know, he just kept asking. And then finally it was the overtly of, well, I'm not going to do you anymore. I'm just not going to do it. You know, you do it on your own and that's it. And for me, it was like, well, no, that he, you know, conditioned me to say, well, no, this is what's right. And this is what feels better. So do that. And so then I finally gave in to, oh, okay, yeah, then that makes sense. And I should, because I don't want to be selfish, you know, because he would paint the picture that, he would, you know, he would satisfy me and I'm not satisfying him because then I'm selfish and I'm a bad person. So I'm sinning in that sense because I'm not taking care of him.
Now, you first met him at church, but he ultimately moved out of just church work. He also became a coach, right?
Yeah.
And then a public school teacher.
Yeah. He was actually going to school at the time to be a math teacher and a baseball coach, everything. And he never wanted to coach varsity because they already had, you know, all the skills. He wanted to teach the kids, you know, freshman, JV. That was his big thing. And then he was the student advisor for Key Club, I think is what it was. It was, you know, a bunch of, you know, social active clubs on school campuses. So it was that. And but yeah, he was very, very involved in his school, and all the students really enjoyed him as a teacher, apparently, because he was the cool teacher. You know, they had all the students called him Richard. They didn't call him Mr. You know, they didn't call him, you know, the formal Mr. It was just, you know what I mean? And so he was their friend. And
so they didn't see him as a creeper, because everybody, and I shouldn't say everybody, many people think, oh, you'd know, he's a creeper.
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. Yeah, not at all. Like his demeanor was that he was almost like in a sense, a ladies' man, because he would have all these women around him while he's in the public eye. But interestingly, though, the women that he chose to be hanging around they're all married. So, you know, he was the good guy for not going out with them, but they wanted to be with him because they were all from broken marriages. They were all from broken homes, and he treated them. In his words, he treated them like a gentleman or like a man should, and so they would want to go out with him, but. He was like, oh, well, you're married. I can't. So he positioned himself very cleverly in that sense to have that demeanor that everyone looked at him as, oh, he's a great guy. All these women like him. There's, you know, why would he need anything else beyond that? Because women are almost, in a sense, throwing themselves at him. And he was just being a gentleman and not doing that because he was a Christian. So he wouldn't sleep with someone before he was married. so he wouldn't do that. So he was a Christian. And so people looked at it as, oh, he's not creepy. He's not, there's nothing to show anything along those lines. Even neighbors, they, you know, they had no idea.
At what point did you have a wake up call to what was happening to you as a child?
Unfortunately, it took a long time. You know, I moved away and I was, you know, I went down a terrible path in my life, you know, drinking, partying, getting every girl I could, you know, depressed. I ended up, you know, at one point trying to commit suicide, and it was just a really bad road that I was on. And then I finally came home from Florida, you know, a few years back, and my brother-in-law at the time, he sat me down for dinner at like a couple, like probably 4 days that I'd been home, and he sat me down and he said, hey, we got to talk. And he had known me, and he had actually known Richard for, gosh, 15 years, 16 years by this time, you know? So I've known my brother-in-law for, you know, since I was five. So, you know, and so he had a good relationship with me, and we were talking, and he just kept asking the question, you know, do you think this was right? Do you think this was, you know, is this okay to do? Is that okay to do? You know, because Richard came on to him as well, trying to manipulate him in that way when they were kids. And so for me, you know, I look at it and I kept looking at it. No, everything's fine. Everything's fine. You know, that's the old life. I'm not going to worry about it. And then finally he asked me the question, if you have kids, would you let Richard babysit them? And I right away said, no, absolutely not. And he said, well, why not? That's, you know, if he's okay, if he's a good guy, why wouldn't you let him? I said, oh, well, just because I don't like the way he treats kids. And they said, but then you were a kid. So how did he treat you? And I just thought back and I was like, oh, I didn't even realize it. Yeah, you're right. And then everything started flooding in, realizing, oh my gosh, yeah, I was a victim for, you know, 11 years of my life. And I had no idea. I didn't even dawn on me that that was even an issue. And then as soon as I heard, you know, I saw it, I'm thinking about it. I'm like, gosh, I'm 26 years old. Why didn't I think about this earlier? And then, you know, but the lucky thing was that California has great laws and the statute of limitations never runs out. So, you know, called the PD, said, hey, this is what's going on. This is what happened to me. I don't know if you guys can do anything, but I don't think you should be around kids. And then that started the whole process. He got arrested, and then the trial happened.
Can you take us through that process of what you did after you had the realization that you were molested as a child? Mm. Did you go and tell anyone? I mean, I know you said you went to the police, but take us briefly through that process of disclosing that to law enforcement and your family.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. For me, it was that moment there. It was big. I mean, it was, you know, turning point in my life. And you know, I was trying to get my life right and going to counseling, doing all that. And then I, you know, contacted the police. And then I first drafted an email, and then I sent an email, a long email to Richard saying, you know you did this. I know you did that. I never want to talk to you again. I don't expect anything from you. You're out of my life. I just want to let you know I know. And then, of course, I never heard anything back. And then I sat down with a family meal with my mom, my sister, my aunt, my uncle, who I was living with at the time, and my brother-in-law, and sat down and said, hey, this is what's going on. You guys may already know because of whatever, but here's what I know and here's what happened to me. So that was a very tough, long, tearful meal, but it was great. I mean, it was liberating, and the family really came together as a cohesive unit, which was beautiful. I mean, I loved that moment, you know, that strong family bond that we had. And then from there, we were working through the trial and where he was arrested. And unfortunately, his family is definitely a not so nice family. Lots of gang affiliation, Mexican mafia, the whole thing. So for a while there, I had a hit out on me, a contract for my life. That wasn't too much fun.
Exactly. But gosh, I wonder why.
Yeah, no kidding. But wow. But for me, it was,
and it felt very long.
It really did. Yeah, it really did. I mean, I know the lucky thing was that at least I guess for law enforcement, the lucky thing was that because of this hit that was out and that was known in the whatever gang underworld or whatever you want to call it, The cops were able to make lots of arrests, so that was good. So that was positive for them, you know, cleaning up the streets a little bit because of me. So the small little thing there. But yeah, I mean, very, very long. Yeah, the process, the trial, the everything was, it literally felt like a lifetime. You know, I mean, it was 2 years, but it was, you know, it felt like 20. So yeah, it was long.
I know that you had an amazing support system, and some of that was the attorney.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And also the two officers. Can you share how they made a difference in your life in that process?
Oh, man. Yeah, it was huge. I mean, what I love, yeah, the DA, assistant DA in Riverside, he, incredible. I mean, especially to know that this is his priority. Like, these are the only cases that he takes, are child molestation cases and our sexual abuse cases. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, gosh, how do you do that? You know, because I was asking him one day, because the best thing about Elon was that he wanted to be more than just the attorney that sat there in the courtroom. He wanted to make sure that I was okay, you know, helping me get all my paperwork done for like victim services. He wanted to make sure that my family was okay, that they were informed as much as possible. You know, he was there for me inside court, outside of court. You know, he made himself extremely available for me, which was huge. And what I loved when I was talking with him just one day, him and I, and I was just asking, why do you do this? You know, why do you want to put yourself through this awful, awful time of hearing these victims and hearing just this pain that everyone goes through? And he said, well, simple enough, because I want, she said, you know, frankly, he wants the bastards put in jail. And I'm like, well, I guess that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what he wanted to do. You know, he says, hey, they deserve to go to jail and I'm going to do it. And he is very good at his job. I think he, at least up until that point, I don't know. I mean, it's been a year and a half since, or 2 years now since the trial, and gosh, 2 years. And, I don't think he hadn't lost a single case. So, he's doing pretty well. You know, he was at the time was like 37-0 or whatever it was. So just incredible. And then not to mention, you know, the PD, I mean, those guys in that, special victims unit or whatever you want to call it, the care and the patience and the detailed work that they have with you, knowing that it's, you know, because you have to tell your story to them and it's in, you know, explicit detail that you have to tell them, and it's on record, and the judge hears it, the jury, everybody hears it, you know, but you have to sit in a room with them and they have to hear it day in and day out. And you know, and for him to just, I mean, 4 hours of me talking about my life and, you know, Andy being in there, and just, he was so warm and so inviting and just kind. I mean, really more than anything, he was just kind. He's definitely on the same line as Elon with the DA, and just saying, hey, you know, no one ever deserves this. And, you know, when we catch him, we put him away. And simple as that. So it was an amazing experience. Like as hard as it was to do all of that, it was just wonderful that I was able to experience it with those two guys and the rest of the PD that was there with Corona PD, you know, with Michelle, the other detective there. I mean, it's just incredible to see how much heart they have for the victims and how much they focus on us. You know, yes, of course they're all about getting the bad guy, but at the same time, their main focus is to serve and protect, and literally that's what they're doing with me. It's great.
And I know that they made you feel like a man. They didn't diminish your manhood at all.
True.
And I really appreciated that in watching them. Could you tell us what the outcome was of the trial? And were you the only male who was John Doe 1, or were there other John Does?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. For me, I mean, especially the male factor, making sure that I was, you know, feeling like I was still a man and I was still, you know, able to be who I wanted to be and not, you know, I wasn't labeled as, you know, Vince the victim, that I was, you know, I was a man. I was Vince the man, and that's it. Vince, plain and simple. And that was a huge, huge thing, especially with the, you know, the thoughts of inadequacy, insecurity sexually and everything. That was really hard, but them being able to pour into me and, you know, realizing that's not where I was going, that was great. And, but then also with the trial, yeah, there was, I think, from my knowledge, at least the ones that I knew of personally, there were 11 total victims that were, you know, on the their report or whatever. But I know that the police had more than that that I didn't know about that were younger than me that I just didn't know who they were. But yeah, I was John Doe, one of 11 that were in the trial, and it was a tough time, you know, doing the trial, being up on the stand and being ripped apart by the defense attorney, you know, unfortunately. But you know, and that was hard, but the most liberating, I guess you can say, fact of the trial was, you know, when he was convicted. That was probably the best the best time there.
That was an amazing day.
That was a good day. That really was a good day. And then when, and especially this, I think the sentencing day was probably a little bit better than the guilty verdict day. But you know, when he gets I think it was 150 years.
150 years. 10 years per 15 counts.
Yeah, and then to life, of course. So whichever comes first. So that was nice, you know, just to hear that. And It was tough a little bit for me. It was a little tough to see Richard's family and how broken they were and how much in denial they were. You know, that was hard for me to, you know, to see, and just, you know, trying to help them. I mean, for me, just trying to help them, interest them, and say, hey, you know, yes, he is a bad person, but you know, you can still move on from this. But they're, you know, set in their ways, and unfortunately, they don't have God in their life, so they don't have anything to really grab onto. And but for me, it was a beautiful thing. You know, the verdict was huge, the sentencing was huge, but more so just the family coming together, you know, being there. My bride-to-be at the time was there, and, you know, with me by my side, my family right by my side, and just seeing people come together and having that strong bond of family and strong bond of just... of almost like a brotherhood, you know, even though there's sisters in there, of course, but you know what I mean? Just having that strong bond between everyone and with you included, of course. And it was a huge day.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to reflect back, but I just want people to understand that you truly understand standing by him and denying what was real.
Yeah.
Because a few years before that, you were on the other side.
That's true. Yeah, that was really hard. Yeah, looking back on it, because there was a victim that came forward when I was about 16, and saying, you know, he did this, he did that, and I took the stand in his defense, in Richard's defense, saying that no, that's never happened. This kid's a liar. This kid doesn't know what he's talking about, and this never happened. I've known him for X amount of years. I live with him. He's never done that to me ever, and. And yeah, and so he got off, you know, he was acquitted on that. And you know, I look back on that and I see that kid and I look at it and he is, to this day, he's not the same. You know, he was not given vindication. I mean, you know, slightly with my trial, but with his own and then with his family life and with everything, it was, honestly, it was awful, you know, to see where he went and, you know, how downtrodden he was, and unfortunately he hung his existence and his in a sense victory on that trial, versus for me, you know, I hung it on knowing that it was in the open, it was out in the light, you know, and just me healing with my family, you know, the kid that came forward before. It was all about he needs to be guilty, and that's it. And when he wasn't, then that just broke him, you know. And I always say, like, there's you can never tell when you go to trial for that, or if someone's convicted of it. You never know, you know, because there's always going to be someone in the jury that I know there wasn't mine too, that says you should have known, and you probably liked it, you probably wanted it, you're actually gay, forget it, and that's not true, you know. And so that's where, for me, I always tell people, hey, it's not about you being vindicated by the courts. It's about you being vindicated with your family, with yourself, with your loved ones, with your God, and that's what's more important. It's not about what a panel of 12 people say. You know, it's about what you say you are, and being that victor, having that victory is more than just, you know, someone saying, you know, that one wonderful word that we love to hear, guilty, but having someone truly say, that's not who you are.
And that's an amazing, freeing perspective. Mm. Because a lot of people do not hear guilty. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the report isn't even taken.
Yeah.
And they feel like personal failures, mm-hmm. or they just are so enraged that that person hasn't spent a day in jail.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And to find that inner strength that you've done your part. Mm-hmm. And some people are going to hear that guilty.
Yeah.
And I remember getting that text that day. I remember exactly where I was when I pulled my phone out, and there you had texted me, guilty. Mm-hmm. And it was the most beautiful text.
Yeah, I remember that day. Yeah.
And, but not everybody has that. I know I didn't have that.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And your sister, she said, Martha, I cannot be at the sentencing, but since you weren't given the opportunity to read your victim impact statement, will you read mine?
Yeah. And that was, I remember when my sister told me what she was going to do and asked you to do that. And that was beautiful. I was blown away that she, you know, thought of you in that way. And, you know, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I didn't think of that. I was just, you know, for me, unfortunately, that was my selfish moment of, oh man, this is great for me. This is great for me. But yeah, it was an amazing thing. And I loved what you said. And I loved how you were able to, you know, be there and support and everything. It's wonderful.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I know for us, we talked that day and it was difficult to watch his family align mm-hmm. themselves with him mm-hmm. because I had experienced when it came out publicly about my perpetrator 20 years prior.
Right.
And then I'd fast forward and just found out that those people who aligned themselves with him,
right.
their grandchildren had just been molested by somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just by putting up those silk screens mm-hmm. and believing in the liar.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Was endangering the next generation.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing. Yeah. Cause it's unfortunately, life is a cycle, and no matter what cycle you're on, it will perpetuate. And that's what's so hard to go against the grain, you know, and realize that just because you were victimized doesn't mean that you can hide behind, you know, your own denial. It's going to affect the generations beyond. And so I know for me and my family, that's definitely something that I will fight to the hill to make sure that doesn't happen to my family.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I know that during the trial, things were thrown out there about sexual orientation.
Mm. Yes, it was.
Such as them saying, well, Richard, so all these gay teenagers just fell in love with you. And,
exactly.
you know, throwing that out there. And you were dating,
yeah.
who's now your wife.
Yeah.
And can you, as his current wife, tell you what that felt like? Because you sat there every day listening to them hurl these lies about the man that you were falling in love with. What did that feel like? And what were those lies doing to your relationship? And how did you work through those?
Yeah, it definitely was very difficult sitting there listening to all these lies and knowing the man that was up on the stand, but not knowing the man that they were accusing him of being. Mm. The man that I fell in love with was strong and courageous and was nothing what they were saying. And so for us, it was a time where Vince and I really got to know each other a lot better. He confided in me in a lot of things, and I knew going into that, I had no idea what to expect, what to do. I had never been on trial or been to a trial, never dealt with anything like this. But I knew that I had to be a rock for him and I had to be strong, because there were days where I saw him just falling apart because things weren't happening. The trial wasn't happening. It was postponed again. And going through that whole process, it grew our relationship, and we just bonded, and it's been definitely amazing, even in our marriage right now. I mean, I don't think our marriage would be as strong as it is without having those times where we had to depend on each other.
Well, there was nothing to hide.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They weren't allowing you to be discreet at all.
No kidding. No kidding.
And it was all laid out there.
Oh, yeah.
So Vince, as a male, knowing that you were straight
mm-hmm.
and knowing that you were courting this woman,
yeah.
what were your thoughts as they were saying all these things about you that you must be gay?
Exactly. Yeah, that was hard. I mean, you know, for me in my life, and I had unfortunately been, you know, labeled that at other times, and you know, and struggle with that for, you know, not to the full extent, but slightly. I've struggled with it as growing up, and just wondering, hey, is this, is this me? Is this, you know, is this normal, what it is? And then realizing, no, this is, you know, this is just what I do at my house, and this is not who I am. And so, but hearing it in the, you know, hearing it secondhand was difficult enough. But then, you know, sitting in the courtroom, hearing the closing statements of the defense attorney saying how that I must be gay, and I'm dating someone just to put up a front because I actually am in love with Richard, and now this is what I really want, and I'm blackmailing him, and so on and so forth. It was hard, you know, it was really hard, and I remember, you know, grabbing onto Ashley's hand and just, you know, just praying and saying, hey, this is, you know, this is not who I am. I know that, and I know that he unfortunately has a terrible job to do, and that's what he's doing. And but it was, nonetheless, it was difficult. It was really difficult to be able to sit there and not be able to defend yourself. That was probably the hardest part, was because I remember, you know, Elon talking to me and saying, hey, he's going to say this, he's going to say that. You are not allowed to say a single word. You cannot say one thing about it. You can't have it. Don't have a bad look on your face. Don't do anything. If you don't want to look at him, that's fine. Don't do anything, or else you're going to mess something up. And I'm thinking, oh, geez. All right. But that's, you know.
Ashley, were you part of that conversation, knowing what was going to come out of his mouth in closing?
I wasn't a part of that conversation, but Vince kind of warned me going into closing statements. Although going into the closing statements, I'd heard everything from all the other guys that were involved in that. So I heard everything from A to Z in that case. So nothing really came as a surprise to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I know, sitting in there every single day, that's hard.
And what was paramount in the two of you working through that? How did you get through that time? Because you were dating. You had an option.
Yeah,
I did.
You could have so left. And I was in the same situation.
Right.
Thankfully, Gary didn't get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he sat there and counseling with other, you know, husbands and that, and he's just dating me, and he's going, what am I getting myself into?
Yeah.
And that's a tough choice. But outside of Vince being Vince, what allowed you to know this was okay? This was the man you wanted to be with in spite of his past?
Yeah, I think for me, there were a couple of things. One, I had just been praying. You know, I reached a point in my life where I was like, okay, I'm done with the whole dating thing. I don't want to do it anymore. I just want to find my husband. I want to, you know, kind of move on from that stage of my life and put things in the past. And so for me, it was an answer to prayer. God, Vince walking into my life, God just said, all right, here's your knight in shining armor. And his armor may be a little dented, but he's still shining.
That's right.
And so, and being able to experience all of that with Vince, I really got to see his strength. Even amidst him falling apart in my arms and crying because he couldn't sleep because he was having nightmares, watching him take that stand when most people would just shove it under the rug and say, oh, it's no big deal, I don't want to deal with it. He sat on that stand, and through the tears, through all the pain, and through the gruesome detail of his testimony, he came out on top. He came out victorious and stronger than ever. And so for me, I looked beyond him as a victim and saw him as the man that I would be proud to stand next to, because he was so strong and so brave and just was amazing. And it was just incredible watching him throughout all of it and be the support for his friends that were involved.
And that's what I saw as amazing, is there were 10 other guys.
Yeah.
And Vince was the cornerstone.
Mm-hmm.
That you stood there and it made it okay for them to be open and honest and transparent.
Yeah.
And you were a group together.
Mm-hmm.
None of you were alone.
Right.
But you started that process.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was out of your courage.
Right.
That they felt it okay to come forward. And every single one of them are amazing in their courage to follow through, to come to court, and to be torn apart. At one moment, each of you was torn apart.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is there anything that your families or Elon did to let you know that they were going to do that,
mm-hmm.
but how you were going to come out on top even with them tearing you apart and throwing all these lies at you and questioning you, what stood out that allowed you to know that this was part of the process and you would rise to the top?
Oh, man. Yeah, I think for Elon, he was definitely the like the grounder. You know, he was the one that grounded me during the time, especially during the trial, because my, you know, everyone was saying, oh, he's guilty. He's going to get a million years. It's going to be great, you know, yada, yada, yada. And he kept saying, hey, you just don't know. You never know. There's 12 people, 12 opinions. You never know. Don't base, because every time I talked to him, don't base your entire life on what 12 other opinions are. You have to base it on your family. You have to base it on your faith. You have to base it on you. That's what you have to do. And you know, for us, and especially as he was talking about, because there was, I mean, minimal prep, you know, because he didn't want to, you know, have any bias with the jury or with anything like that. So it was very, very minimal prep that he did with me. It was more so with the detectives, with Andy, especially from the PD. And both of them were just saying, hey, this is exactly what's going to happen. And, you know, laying out, they're going to ask you, are you gay? They're going to ask you, did you like it? They're going to ask you, why did you allow it to happen? You were, you know, you're 21 years old. Why would you, you know, you have the easy decision to make, you know, you're doing this, like you know, you allowed it to happen, like, you know, and everything they're saying, because, you know, the defense asked, hey, you know, yeah, I understand maybe when you're a kid, you didn't know what was going on, but you're 18, you're 21, like you're still on this happened. So you really wanted it. This is what you wanted in your life. And you know, and Andy and Elon both said, hey, they're going to ask you this, and you have to have an answer of something. You have to say something to be honest, but, you know, just say, hey, this isn't what you chose. This isn't what you want. And for me, that's exactly right. You know, if I had a choice, this would be the last of them, you know, but.
So at 21, you didn't feel you had a choice. It was like you said, it was like brushing your teeth.
Right.
It was what you did.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And it's strange to me, even now looking back, I was like, I was literally in college, you know, I was away, and I'd come home on the weekends. And that's what we did. And that's it. You know, it wasn't any different for me. You know, I was like, oh, I just happen to be living in a different place, you know, and that's all it was. And looking back, you know, and especially with the defense asking me and people talking to me about it, saying, hey, like, you should have known better. You're an adult. Adults know better. That just doesn't make, it's common sense, is that, you know, that you don't do that if you don't want it. But the difference is that, you know, when you start at 11, it's not exactly the same thing. You know what I mean? And you have a different outlook on life when something's been ingrained in you forever. You know, it's almost like those, I guess to put it kind of plainly, with families, you know, that traditional Thanksgiving dinner, they, you know, it's what you do. It's just something that you do. You have to do it. It's family, and that's what you do. For me, it was similar in that way. It's something that you just have to do because it's family. Because at that point, I still felt that he was my family, and that's what we do. He's, you know, some people may think he's weird, but I love him. I love him anyways, you know, and as a brother, and but that's what was, you know, torn apart, and that's what was, you know, made me to feel like I was the one that was asking for it, and yeah.
And I think unless you've been there, it is very difficult to understand.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, how numb your brain can come, but really it's a survival mechanism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where our body tries to protect us. Mm-hmm. And so it numbs us to the real feelings of confusion and logic.
Yeah.
Because there is no logic.
Exactly.
In traditional sense.
True.
But we do. We follow through and we protect that person. We spend a lifetime protecting that person. Until something awakens us.
Oh, yeah.
And we're sometimes not even awakened till we're 55.
Exactly.
You know, so it's miraculous that at 26, you had your awakening. Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
And you were able, within the statute of limitations, to file.
Yeah.
And to watch him, or not watch him.
Exactly, yeah.
Knowing he was in an orange suit and he'd live in that suit the rest of his life.
Exactly. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That was definitely a huge, huge thing for me. And just like, even now though, it's, you know, cause sometimes I do still, you know, unfortunately, it still affects me, and, you know, I still think about it sometimes, and, you know, I'm getting better at talking to my wife about that and letting her know that, hey, you know, I had a nightmare last night, or I don't know why I just went online and went on Megan's Law and found him. And I want to know, you know, if he's still there, if he's in, you know, High Desert Prison up by Lake Tahoe. I know exactly where he is, you know. And if, you know, if I thought hard enough, I'd probably remember what his, you know, prison
Mine's
number
in
is.
San Diego in a retirement home.
There you go.
Yeah. Just looked up today, actually.
Yeah.
I think he's about 98 years old.
There you go.
Tick, 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 tick.
A good die young.
You know.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, in your relationship, what are some of those challenges?
Mm-hmm.
What yeah. are the challenges that you face, and then how do you work through them?
Mm.
Because that's something most people don't talk about, but they're crying out and needing to understand what goes on in a marital relationship.
Oh, yeah.
So you, Vince, and others like you and I can be real and transparent. And then people like Gary or yourself, Ashley, know how to, I don't want to say deal with them because that sounds so distant.
Yeah.
But how do you deal with us?
In a sense, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a learning curve for me. But one thing that I'm learning is to not take his silence as a statement against who I am, and to give him time, because a lot of times Vince will just need to process, and he does tend to keep things inside and doesn't tell me. But I know I've gotten to know him in a way where I know something's bothering him, and I'll ask him a couple times, but if he won't tell me, then he's not ready to tell me. And so I think for me, I'm learning where that limit is, where that line is of how far I can push him until he's like, okay, I don't want to talk to you at all.
Mm.
But definitely, and still even beyond when it happened, beyond the trial, is still not looking at him as a victim. Because I think the moment I start looking at him as like, okay, oh, you know, you're going through this again, I'm so sorry. If I look at him that way or deal with him in that regard, then he doesn't respond in the way that he should. Mm. You know, he'll clam up and not say anything.
All right.
Right.
It's almost like that pity, you know, like that's it. You don't want to have pity, you know,
right.
You want to have support.
Even when people say to me, oh, you're so courageous. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's like, just what I'm supposed to do. I'm
exactly.
supposed to be transparent. Yeah,
exactly.
I get it.
Exactly.
I had it said to me 3 times a day, and I'm like, and someone said, just say thank you. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Another thing, too, that I'm learning is a lot of his actions now and decisions he makes are influenced by where Richard was coming from. And so for me, understanding that, and thankfully, and I don't know if it's thankfully, but thankfully for me, I was able to sit through the trial, and I have a very good picture and understanding of what happened.
Exactly. And you know exactly who Richard was and the ploys he used.
I know who he was. Yeah. And I watched him on stand saying, nope, I would never do anything like that.
Right.
I watched him lie through his teeth. So I can sympathize with Vince, and I understand the type of person he was dealing with. So for me, it makes my understanding a little bit easier. Doesn't mean it's easier for us to interact.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a marriage. We'll have our issues, but... Yeah. Always keeping that, it's just keeping that perspective and understanding why I'm there. I'm there to minister to him. Like, he is my ministry. I'm not there to, I can't save him all the time, but I can minister to his needs, and I can love him the way that Christ has called me to love him as a wife.
Definitely.
What are some of the challenges you face outside of like those moments of silence, but what are those, what you may see as unique challenges in your marriage relationship?
Well, I'll do all the talking on this one.
I'd love to hear.
I'll be truthful about everything. Up to you.
Well, my mic's not working.
2012 AD.
One of them is just the reason he interprets something that I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's been something that we've actually been dealing with recently is... Mm-hmm. is I will do something and I don't know, I could try and reach out to him, but he doesn't want anything to do with it. He sees it as like, what are you doing?
Right.
And it's me, I'm interpreting it like, I'm just trying to love you. okay.
Yeah.
What do you want from me?
That's true.
I've never felt that before. I'm lying now.
So for us, it's a lot of just motivation behind his actions and knowing where he comes from in that. And so our challenge is when we're communicating.
Yeah.
Because he won't necessarily communicate everything to me, and he'll say an answer very straightforward, like, oh yeah, I'm good. But I can look at him and see in his face there's so much more going on beyond that.
Right. That's true.
You know, he says he, you know, the nightmares that he has, he actually kicked me in one of them. Full on kicked me. Yeah. And
I think you had a pretty good bruise.
I did, yes. And but the next morning it was, okay, you had a nightmare big enough to kick me, so are you okay? Oh yeah, I'm fine.
That's when you ask her if she's okay, because you inflicted a wound.
Right. A good husband would have loved to do that, yeah, and would have ministered to her in that way. I got ready for work.
You selfish being.
Yeah, really. Yeah. But Ashley's absolutely right. And, you know, communication is a huge, huge thing. And, you know, you can read every marriage book in the world about it and try to figure it out, but unless you start doing it, it doesn't matter what you're reading. You know, all the knowledge in the world isn't good without any actions. And I think for me, that's a huge thing of one, not reading into her communication or lack of or whatever, and thinking that, well, she must be thinking this because she said that, or she must be feeling this because she did that, whatever it is, you know, and not taking my insecurities as her faults. I think that's a huge thing, because a lot of times, I know people do this. I know, you know, of course I can only speak from my personal perspective, but I know that, you know, with the insecurities that I have in my own life, I look at it and say, oh, well, it's her fault because she's not clean enough. You know, I'm OCD and I need things to be clean immediately. You know, I used to have to, for some reason in my mind, the kitchen had to be 100% spotless, dishes cleaned and put away, pots and pans, everything, before I sat down to eat my dinner. And my dinner would be cold most of the time because I would just have to have everything clean. I would vacuum my house every day. I, you know, all these things that were just so OCD in my life. And then I look at it as, you know, and when, especially when we're first married, it was, well, it's her fault because she's dirty.
Well, but you said earlier, I mean, that's the amazing part of your story is,
right,
what did you say about Richard? That you had to take a shower.
Exactly.
Because he hated being dirty.
Oh, yeah.
So the person who was spending the most time raising you,
mm-hmm,
being Richard, planted those thoughts what's now clinically called OCD.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, striving for better, doing this, doing that. Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah. You know, and I look at it, you know, before I just saw it as, well, no, this is just who I am and you need to deal with it. But now I look at it as, wait, this is who I am and we need to help each other, you know, and I can't fault Ashley, especially for being a human being, you know, and she has her amazing abilities in her life, being a mom. I mean, she's the best mom I've ever seen in my whole life. Of course, I know my mom's sitting in the lobby and she's probably not liking that, but I love...
She said it's okay. It's fine. As she takes care of your baby.
There you go. Exactly. You know, and just the love that Ashley pours out, not only on me, but on everyone else, especially at church and with family and just the people that are in our lives and how much she genuinely cares and loves about people. And that's the things that I am now realizing, you know, it's only been 2 years, so it's easy to do that. Now I'm realizing that I need to just accentuate her strengths and minimize her weaknesses instead of the other way around. And it's pretty easy to do that with Ashley, just because of how many strengths she has and how strong she truly is as that woman of God that she is, that Proverbs 31 woman that I love, and how just amazing she is in my life. It's a beautiful thing.
And it's exciting watching this, because I met you when you were dating,
mm-hmm,
and in the midst of literally a trial,
mm-hmm,
and yeah, figuratively. But you stood by your man, and it's amazing to watch. And I appreciate you both being transparent. And before we go, I just want you each to share three things that you think every wife of a victim of sexual abuse needs to know. And you sharing with the men, what are the three things they need to know Let's start with you, Ashley.
Oh, man, put me on the spot. Okay, one is definitely seeing your husband not as a victim. Seeing the strength that it takes to overcome that and to actually admit that something like that happened, especially for a guy. There's so much pride involved in that, in that admittance of this happened to me. So definitely seeing them as victorious and not seeing them as a victim. And I think standing by them no matter what, letting them know that you're going to be there, whether it be you just hold his hand or you give him words of encouragement or whatever love language he has, showing him that you're there no matter what. And I don't know what a third one is.
Well, come back if you have one.
Well, and I think my third one is not not pushing them to explain everything.
That's a big one.
Because curiosity can sometimes get the best of us, and right. You know, I got to hear everything, but knowing everything is not—it's not always a good thing.
Yes,
exactly, that's true. And that's what we encourage parents not to strive to know everything. It can actually break you down more than build up that child. Yeah. And it goes the same with your spouse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know for my husband, he's asked not to know it all.
Right.
You know, it really wounds him as a man that he couldn't protect me.
Yeah.
And so that's a great tidbit of advice to not seek it out of curiosity. It actually can be quite destructive. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Definitely.
And Vince.
I would say as a man that the biggest thing is that you are not alone. And in regards to that you know, the statistics that men never like to look at, of course, you know, 1 in 7 is huge. And you know, when you look at that stat, 1 in 7, and that's 1 in 7 reported.
And I, you know, yeah, we believe it's much higher.
Oh yeah, I would venture to say it's probably closer to, I would say, you know, 1 in 4, 1 in 3, probably.
Easily.
Probably for guys. And so just knowing that, but a lot of times for guys, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1, you know, it's me. And you know, you're not alone. And that was the biggest thing I needed to know, that I was not alone, that there were people around me that cared for me, that supported me, that loved me, that wanted to be there for me, that truly unconditionally loved me. And that was a big, big thing about that. You're not alone. And knowing that my God is bigger than any problem that I will ever face. And the second one would definitely be to find that support and find that opportunity to be able to lean on people. Honestly, in some regard, it doesn't matter who they are as long as they have an open ear. But in other regard, you know, that's what most people say. But in other regard, it's like, no, you need to find the right person. You know, for me, you know, relying on my wife and relying on my family, my pastors, my counselor, you, of course, Martha, and just realizing that it takes a certain type of person to truly give support. Because if someone just simply says, oh, you're courageous, oh, you know, I'm so sorry, they're not the type of person that's going to support you. They're the type of person that's going to pity you. And that's the last thing that you need, you know, especially your manhood is shaken when things like this happen in your life, and if all you're ever told is that that you're a victim, and that, you know, which comes to the third one, that you're defined as that you're a victim and you're this and you're that, and you will never amount to anything because you are simply broken, and people looking to you and saying you haven't grieved enough, you haven't, like, well, you're not defining me, I'm defining me, you know, and you know, that support of people saying, hey, no, if you want to cry, you can cry. If you want to go and never talk about it, we'll never talk about it. If you want to just go and, you know, have an experience that is genuine and that is, you know, appropriate between two males, then do that. Absolutely. That's where that support comes in. And like I already said, with the definition for guys, that, you know, I am not Vince the victim. You know, I'm Vince. Plain and simple. And that was the biggest thing that, you know, especially in my victim impact statement at the end of the trial to the judge before he's carried out his sentence. That was the for me, the most impactful statement of just saying, hey, I'm not defined by what happened to me. You know, I'm not defined by what people say I am. I'm defined by who my God says I am. I'm defined by who my loved ones say that I am. And then, of course, who I say I am. And I think that definition is a big thing, especially for guys, because, you know, as soon as that label is taken away from us, we try to fill it with everything else, you know. But when we have that strength of conviction, knowing that we are exactly who God wants us to be, then it's a beautiful thing.
I so appreciate the two of you being here. You show an amazing open window of who you are and who our listeners can be. And this is the place where we want you to find that home to be yourself.
Definitely.
Where you can be you, you can be heard, you can be yourself, plain and simple.
Mm-hmm.
And A Quarter Blue wants to be there for you. Whatever you need to reach out to us and let us know how we can help you and walk through this time with you and equip you so you can be empowered in fighting back and getting your feet on the ground and walking boldly in who you are. You were created for greatness, and you might need a little help. But as you put your feet on the path, step by step, we will help you get there. So reach out to us at aquarterblue.org. You can send us an email at info@aquarterblue.org also. This is Martha Nix Wade. We appreciate you greatly for you listening. Will you pass this on to others so they too know that they can be themselves in whatever trial they've experienced and rise to the top, for beauty will rise out of those ashes that seem like they are your life. You are not a victim. You are a victor who has great things in store for you. Have a great night.